This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I have three interviews for you, including important climate science from France, activism in North America, and how Belgian reactors frighten Europe. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. On Tuesday, May 10th, 2016, the Italian Coast Guard rescued almost 5,000 African migrants attempting to cross the Mediterranean Sea. That could be, as they say, the tip of the iceberg. Very serious new science from France, published in the Proceeding of the National Academy of Sciences, concludes, quote, "We estimate that, without any adaptation measures, tens to hundreds of millions of people could be forced to leave the Sahel by the end of this century," end quote. They are talking about unmitigated climate change, which may or may not happen, depending on us. A grave danger to many millions of North African people is incredibly coming from Greenland. This is a mega story for planet Earth, and it's getting buried in the noise of the current crisis. Let's go straight to the new science. I've reached Dr. Gilles Ramstein. He's the co-author of the new paper and a senior French climate researcher and modeler. Gilles is with the LSCE, Le Laboratoire de Sciences du Climat et de l'Environnement, and part of the University of Versailles. From Saint-Aubin-Esson, Gilles Ramstein, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Obviously, it's difficult to connect climate warming in Greenland to unheard-of mass migration out of North Africa. Why don't we begin with an orientation, Gilles? Where is the Sahel?
So the Sahel, the region where we made our study, is from 10 east to 10 west and from 8 north to 18 north. It is a south of northern Africa. It is a very vulnerable region of Africa, which is really depending on crops. And today, because of change in climate and variability, it's already a region of very vulnerable from the climate point of view. So this is why we were interested to this area. Moreover, it's also a region, if you look to the demography, which is still with many, many children. The family is still 7 or 8 children, whereas in North Africa, it's more 2 or 3. So it is also planned to be one of the most demographic region in the next 15 years.
And then at the other pole of this climate equation that you write about is Greenland. What is happening there that causes you concern?
So, in fact, as you know, there are kind of prescribed scenarios. These prescribed scenarios come from the IPCC, and we get different scenario of CO2 evolution. And this report are the basis. It is the basis for the evolution of the 21st century. So what we do, we explore from that possibilities of destabilization, accelerated destabilization, or partial melting of the Greenland ice sheet. Why we did that? We did that because me and some of the co-author of this paper are coming from paleoclimate. They learn and they try to understand how climate evolved from billions to thousands of years before. And we know perfectly from the data, not from projection, but from real data, that there were instabilities of the ice sheets, and these instabilities already occurred and have global effect that we can measure through data all over the world.
And there has been talk, Gilles, even among seasoned scientists, that Greenland could melt much faster than predicted in the latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. What do you think?
This is perfectly true. There is different scenarios, as I told you. Some are more realistic, others are more optimistic. Unfortunately, in 2017, we are on the railroad of the most pessimistic one, called RCP 8.5. So this is quite something very scientific, but it means only that there is a scenario for the 21st century, and these scenarios account for the most pessimistic emission. But we are on this scenario yet, and I think there is no many chances that we change the trajectory in the next few years. So from that scenarios, we know that what could happen is that the Greenland will melt. So we can measure that already today with satellite data. And scenarios as the RCP 8.5, which has been performed by 32 different models in the world, in the IPCC show that the sea level rise could reach from 40 centimeters to 1 meter. And this will not be only due to Greenland or Antarctica melting, but a part of this is due to this melting. And another part is just the fact that a water molecule, when it's warmer, it extends in volume and it takes more volume. So this also contributes to the sea level rise. But to come back to your question, today the satellite data measurements show that Greenland is melting, and we expect a melting of about 1 meter at the end of the century, and not only due to Greenland. And so our idea was to say, okay, from the IPCC scenario, let's explore what could happen if we get a destabilization and accelerated partial melting of Greenland ice sheets during this century.
Gilles, you co-authored two previous papers on something which may or may not be important for our understanding of extreme climate possibilities. Could you explain what a Heinrich event is?
Yes, of course, but you have to think about, before I explain what is a Heinrich event, that whatever will happen, it will not be as a Heinrich event. I will explain you the context for a Heinrich event. Before, we have not two ice sheets as Greenland and Antarctica as today, but 20 kilo years before present, 20,000 years before present, we get four ice sheets. And most of the time of the last million of years, we get four ice sheets. So there were two supplementary ice sheets. One was located in North America and the other one in North Europe. And these ice sheets were huge. They get 3 kilometers high. And they correspond both together to 120 meters of sea level drop. And just to have an idea, today, if the Greenland completely melted, it would be about 6 meters. And if Antarctica completely melted, it would be about 60 meters. So these former ice sheets over Europe and North America were really huge. And one of these, the Laurentide ice sheet, the one that was located over North America and Canada, was unstable. What does it mean? It means that every 6,000 or 7,000 of years, she loses a lot or a part of her of its mass. That means that a lot of iceberg, what we could call iceberg surges, go in the North Atlantic and frozen the North Atlantic. And why this has global impact? This is very important to understand. The ocean is very, very huge, but there is only some places where you can form the dense water that will go to the bottom of the ocean. You have to get very dense water. That means salty and cold water. What happened in this area when an ice sheet is melting? It's bringing a lot of melt water, which are, in fact, not salty. So they destroy the fact that you can put in the bottom of the ocean a lot of new water. So they cut the ocean circulation. And this is measured because in the past we can have data, and so we know that each time this kind of surges occurred, it cuts the circulation of the ocean, and so it cuts also the pattern that we are used to of Gulf Stream, and it reorganized completely the atmospheric of the tropical area. So we get many of these events during glacial time when there were Laurentide ice sheets, and all of these events corresponds to a large decrease of the Western African monsoon, and this also can be measured by data. So we perfectly know that when you get a large surge of iceberg in the North Atlantic, this corresponds by ocean dynamics and atmosphere reorganization to a large decrease of Western African monsoon. So these are from the data that it's, and we can explain that also by modeling. Now the new context today of the 21st century has nothing really to see with that. First, because increased very, very rapidly the CO2. So the forcing on the climate is huge, really huge. On the other end, we have not only two ice sheets, and the Greenland ice sheet is very small compared to the Laurentide ice sheet. But we perfectly know that the interaction between this cryosphere and climate are highly nonlinear, and the melting of an ice sheet that we also know from the paleoclimate data is not a very smooth and linear melting. It melts by kind of surge of iceberg. And so it's not stupid to explore the fact that it could happen in the next future, a surge of iceberg from Greenland.
And your previous paper suggests that if the Rhone and Ross ice shelves in Antarctica gave way, there could be serious consequences. Would that affect the southern hemisphere, like Australia, for example?
Well, in fact, in this paper that we published in PNAS, we only described surge of iceberg from Greenland, but in fact what we did with my colleague, we did that for Greenland and for West Antarctica, which is another vulnerable ice sheet location. And as you said, with another colleague that is also included in this study called Jorge Alvarez Sola, he developed a new theory that was published in Nature Geoscience some years ago that showed that, in fact, during the warming that we are producing, we are warming also the ice shelves. And the ice shelves are on the water. So if you melt the ice shelves, strictly speaking, you don't increase the sea level rise, but because these ice shelves, they get a stressing effect on the ice sheets. If they disappear, you get more ice from the ice sheets coming to the ocean. So they get a very important role to stabilize the ice sheets. So what we showed in these previous papers was that the vulnerability from the ice shelves come from the ocean, not from the atmosphere only. Because the ocean is warming the ice shelves, and if the ice shelves tends to disappear, this will make very vulnerable the ice sheets. So yes, there is also a possible impact from the vulnerability of the ice shelves, the Ross-Pichner ice shelf, from the southern hemisphere. But this paper that we published is more focused on the northern hemisphere. Why? Because there is a direct link between the surges of Greenland and the Western Africa, and because the Western Africa is drastically important for millions of people. So it's much more important, I would say, to focus this ice sheet rather than Western Antarctica in terms of demography of population, of course.
Now, your new paper in PNAS is titled Consequences of Rapid Ice Sheet Melting on the Sahelian Population Vulnerability. It's hard for us to understand how changes in Greenland ice melting can affect people in inland Africa. Could you please walk us through the process of how that happens and take as long as you want to take us through those steps?
Yeah, I will try to make it understand. So the first thing you are thinking about when you think about melting an ice sheet is that you just increase the water in the sea, so you get a sea level rise. So people, when they think to that, melting of the ice sheets, and this is also what is shown in the IPCC, is that this will have drastic and dramatic consequences on the coastal area. But in fact, what we show in this paper is that if you get an accelerated melting of Greenland, as I explained before, you have global consequences because you just drastically decrease the transfer of meridian ocean circulation from the tropics to the high latitude, because you are bringing a lot of water which is not salty enough, and so you destroy the area of deep water formation. And this is the reason why a Greenland or West Antarctica melting, if it is accelerated, could have major and global effects. This is the first point. It is a change that it produces in terms of ocean circulation. But something which is also very important is because of these changes, it will also change the atmospheric dynamics in the tropical area, because it will change the region of depression, and it will also have an impact on the monsoon distribution. So the monsoon in this context will be first damped, and then it will be displaced southward. And this is not something which is only a model result. It is something that is observed in the past during each Heinrich event. That means that there is a robust link between surge of icebergs in North Atlantic and weakening of the Western African monsoon.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Gilles Ramstein, a climate researcher from the LSCE in France. As we speak, Gilles, there are several famines in North African countries. The United Nations has sent out an urgent warning. There's the drying of Lake Chad, and in northern Mali, 5 million people are classified as in a crisis-level famine. How does that present compare to the, quote, mega drought that your new work suggests is possible in this century?
Well, you're right to say that there is already, it's already a major and a vulnerable area. You're perfectly true, and it was also true in the 70s. So this area is certainly, just because of the climate variability, a region which is really fragile. And so what we show in our paper is that in the case of accelerated Greenland ice sheet melting, this region will experience a drastic climate changes in terms of monsoon and precipitation. So the major result in terms of climate is the fact that the summer precipitation, which are most of the part of the precipitation for this area, will be shifted and damped. And this means that, the precipitation will be low enough not to allow anymore any agriculture system. That means that it will be lower than the threshold for sorghum and millet that are the major cereals that are cultivated in this area. So this will involve, in fact, a major loss of agricultural area. So what is quite important in our paper, despite all what we discussed about climate, is that we constitute a dreaming team, I would say, with not only people from climate, but also people from statistics to be sure that the signal was robust enough, and also people from the agricultural system, from the RRD in France, Institute for Research and Development, that are in charge of this kind of countries, and also people from the migration and climate migration, people that are able to compute how much people will be able to leave this area. So we go from climate to migration, in fact. And so, yes, this area, to answer to your question, is already very vulnerable, and in our scenario, will be much more vulnerable in maybe 50 to 60 years, if such the scenarios appear.
On October 29th, I reported in 2007, Sir James Lovelock made a startling speech to the Royal Academy in the United Kingdom, and therein he presented a map which showed a climate-changed Earth where deserts encircled the globe, including not just Africa, but also much of China and nearly all of the United States. Your paper seems a step closer to that disaster. Gilles, have you seen such predictions?
Oh, yes, I know a little bit of about the work of James Lovelock in terms of accounting for human beings and relationships with climate. But here it's another story. Our aim here is just to focus on the fact that if you melt an ice sheet and if you do it quite quickly, that means you pour some of the partial melting of the Greenland ice sheet, you not only fill the sea with water, you also drastically change the atmospheric and ocean physics, and this has for consequences to seriously diminish the African monsoon. This is all what we said. So it has, of course, some link with the predictability of Lovelock in terms of maps, but it is based on more, I would say, physical-based climate model results. And I think it's quite different, even if you can put that in a broader context. But I will not go into a planetary catastrophe. I think all what we said here as a multidisciplinary team is we have to explore scenarios that are plausible to make understand to politics and also a large audience population that some consequences can be just unexpected but really drastic.
Well, we'll get right back to your latest science about an unthinkable threat to Africa from Greenland melting. But first, I want to ask you, in the political theater, your new president, Emmanuel Macron, has responded to Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord with an invitation to American climate scientists to join the science of France. Do you personally think this could be the liftoff point where European climate science leads the world?
Well, first, I have to say that this paper has been published in the PNAS, which is a United States Academy. I think there is a very strong and good climate science in the U.S. and also in Canada. I mean, so I think that, yes, you're right, with what Trump said and what his new policy, I think it could make vulnerable our colleague in the States if they have not found it yet anymore. If there is problem like that, I think it's a good intention from the French president to say that we can host these people. But on the other side, as you know, there are also problems with funding the fundamental research in France. So I don't see really well as we can host all these people. But it's anyway, it's a good intention. I think it's very important to develop the climate research. And I'm quite convinced that the new way that Trumps want to drive the American policy is good, even for the development of this country. I'm not convinced.
So your paper published in PNAS assumes the worst trajectory used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, known as the 8.5 pathway. Suppose the world comes to its senses relatively soon and we manage the lower 4.5 IPCC pathway. Gilles, what does that do for your projection for Africa?
Yes, in fact, I think that to answer directly to your question, if we manage the risk, if we are able to get a scenario that is better, I mean, which has less amplitude and corresponds to less CO2 in the atmosphere, of course, we may avoid such destabilization. That doesn't mean that with the RCP 8.5, we necessarily will have this destabilization, but we can, with more statistically, more possibility to destabilize the Greenland. If you are able, and if we are able, which is what we hope, to control, to monitor our CO2 emission in this century, of course, this will have less impact and less possibly a destabilization of the Greenland and West Antarctica ice sheet. So this is in favor of managing our emission, of course.
The current level of immigration has already set off many changes in Europe, as you know, including a run for the presidency by the anti-immigration candidate Marine Le Pen. Now let's fast forward to the end of this century, in a future where humans fail to respond to the climate threat, if that happens. Your paper considers hundreds of millions of people could possibly have to leave North Africa. What would that mean for Europe, do you think?
In fact, in this paper, we really focus on the continent and a monsoon area. But anyway, if at the end of this century we get something as 1 meter of sea level rise, with a problem of salinization of the rice and a lot of problems that will occur in Asia, this only on the coast will have serious damage and will oblige a lot of people to move anyway. If you superimpose to this coastal damage due to the sea level rise and salinification, migration of 10 to 100 million of people due to the fact that you're also impacting the monsoon area, then you get something even more catastrophic. And this is one reason more to account for this threat and to manage the emission of CO2. This is a very, very important thing for us. It is that these unexpected consequences of accelerated ice sheets could oblige you to really consider the fact that we should manage our emission during this century and attenuate as it is possible the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere.
Quite often after the long process of getting a paper to publication, the scientist has moved on to something new. Gilles Ramstein, what are you working on now?
And so now I'm working on two different things. I'm working on to explain how the Greenland ice sheets build up and maintain this last 2.7 million of years. So this is a very fascinating topic. And another topic I'm working on is much more related to this paper, is that if you really change the atmosphere in tropical area, if you change the pattern of precipitation, you will also have major risk on pathogen vectors, as for instance, paludes, malaria, Zika. A lot of pathogen vectors are really driven by precipitation pattern changes, and they can colonize new area. So this is another topic between climate and epidemiology that I'm studying now with another colleague from Liverpool called Cyril Caminade, and we are working on this, more on the biological side of these changes.
Yes, I can remember about 10 years ago when I started, a scientist saying to me, Alex, when it comes to climate change, don't just think about heat. Watch the water changes. Watch the hydrology changes, because those are going to be key to a lot of what we see on Earth. Now, from the science I've seen, I think we're already committed to passing the 2 degrees C danger mark. Honestly, as a person rather than, say, as an institution, what do you think?
I think that it is tremendously important to make research and to communicate Because in the next decades, in the next 50 years, which is quite a long, but we have to educate people so that they can face to this danger that where they will have to cope with. So I think we have to make research and also to educate people so that they have the keys to understand what will happen around them.
As we finish up, is there anything else you would like to say or a final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I just want to insist on the fact that we are not doing some catastrophic scenarios. We are just exploring possibilities. That doesn't mean that this will happen. That just means that it is now a possibility because we are changing the Earth so fast that we have to explore all the consequences of these changes.
We've been speaking with Dr. Gilles Ramstein from the LSCEF in France. Dr. Ramstein has headed up several European science projects with many countries participating. He's the co-author of a new paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The title is Consequences of Rapid Ice Sheet Melting on the Sahelian Population Vulnerability. Find links to that paper, our guests, and the issues we've talked about in my weekly show blog published at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much, and thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thanks, Alex. It was quite interesting.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. People around the world are suffering weather disasters made more violent by global warming. Carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere just hit a new all-time high. But a lot of eyes are glued to the cable channels to see the Donald Trump show in Washington. How can we get any signal through that noise? Has the climate action movement taken a little break? Let's ask an activist leader. Joanna Kerr is the executive director of Greenpeace Canada. Before that, she was chief executive of ActionAid International. She's been a policy director at Oxfam Canada and a leader in both women's rights and North-South dialogue. Joanna Kerr, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Lovely to be here.
You started at Greenpeace in late 2013 during the reign of Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and Mr. Harper did his best to muzzle or get rid of climate scientists. He seemed, in fact, to be an undeclared agent of big oil and gas companies. That sounds so familiar. What advice can you offer our American friends now that the denier-in-chief wants to slash research there and get out of the Paris Agreement?
It's a really good question. I think what we were able to do under Harper was to educate a much more mainstream public about the collusion between big oil and government. So really trying to demonstrate the link between oil and state. That certainly helped in terms of then making the connections with the science muzzling, the silencing of activism. You know, this was a government under Harper who brought in a whole new audit mechanism to audit charities, and particularly it was primarily an attack on environmentalists, and so tying them up through really onerous and protracted long auditing processes. So we were able to just keep connecting the dots between big oil, money, and a very explicit corporate agenda. I think what you all have going on now is that those links are so naked. You've had in your White House neoliberalists before, but the naked truth now about how much collusion there has been between big coal, big oil, and governments now is an opportunity for the general public to start making different decisions as consumers, obviously as voters from the local to the state to the national level, and as investors, you know, where they want to invest their money, where they want to park their savings in what banks are going to be supporting big climate-destroying infrastructure projects. So do not give up hope. This is actually a moment where more people than ever, I think, are going to see the raw greed and those relationships bare naked, and then how individuals can change their relationships with various corporate interests.
Now, for our international listeners, please tell us what the Canadian tar sands operations actually look like on the ground. Have you been there?
Yes, I have. It's, as I understand it, to be the largest industrial project in the world, and it is just this giant scar. I was up in a small plane flying over it a couple years ago. There's very, very strong stench of all the chemicals. It was quite nauseating, actually. And for as long as the eye could see from horizon to horizon to horizon, all you can see is this big open sand pit with these ginormous trucks, you know, a human standing in front of the wheels of one of these trucks. You're just kind of half size of the, just the wheels of these trucks. So trucks just digging out kilo after megaton of sand, scarring into the land there. So there's absolutely no trees. And then of course, it's bitumen that they are digging for that are sitting inside the sand. And so the sand has to be washed with water. So vast, vast amounts of fresh water get used to clean the sand with water and then also with chemicals. And then that gets dumped out into these huge ponds, you know, tailing ponds where this water sits for 25 years, where there used to be glorious rivers and climate-saving boreal forests and on indigenous lands. This is what this looks like. The workers live in workers' barracks that look pretty prison-like. And these tailing ponds, they look like lakes, and they are attractive to migrating birds that fly over. And of course, if a duck was to land in them, they would die. So there are these guns, air guns, that sit on the sides of these ponds, and they go off every 30 seconds? So you hear these guns going off as well. So it's like actually being in a battle zone. So from the smell to the sound to the sight, it's a pretty horrendous place.
It just makes me so sad that humans think that we have the right to do that, and it'll end up in somebody's gas tank maybe, and it looks like it will end up in more gas tanks in world markets with the expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline to Vancouver and the Dakota Access pipeline to American refineries, if that ever happens. And all this was approved by a supposedly climate-aware new prime minister, Justin Trudeau. It seems, Joanna, it just doesn't matter who's in power. This energy steamroller keeps on going.
Yes, I mean, I think a lot of governments want to measure their strengths by being a energy superpower. And certainly through the decades of free markets and globalization, the ability to sell a commodity in high demand is something that any government will try to drive, even though none of these projects necessarily create hundreds of thousands of new jobs. They really do actually increase the wealth of corporate executives. I don't actually think the Kinder Morgan project will be built. I just see in the 3.5 years that I've been at Greenpeace, just to see the rise of environmental awareness, how the pipelines are really seen as kind of the battleground, the front lines of the climate battle, and that it's similar to what is happening in the U.S., you know, where the feds might approve it. You're seeing at the subnational level, certainly in the cities, and most certainly in terms of indigenous communities, very, very explicit resistance. At the same time, you're seeing a business community that is recognizing through innovation and through looking towards the future just how much we all have to gain by transitioning to renewable energy. I think the risk, not just in terms of the climate change, but also the investment risk for increasing number of companies and individuals and pension funds that recognize that this is extreme dirty oil and very expensive in which to process and then move, that in terms of a longer term bet, the opportunities are just increasing multifold and the cost of renewables are going down, that we're hoping the timing will be right, that the projects will just never get built and that the return on investment for those companies will just diminish in such a way that it won't be worth expanding the tar sands, and ultimately we'll be able to phase it out in the next couple of decades and transition all of those workers in Alberta. Many have come from other places, that they get transitioned into clean jobs. But I just remain so hopeful because of what I have seen on all of those levels in terms of the consciousness of vast amount of the middle class, of the throngs of people that come out to these climate marches from all walks of life, just the very, very smart legal challenges by Indigenous communities, and of course then the business sector saying, you know, we need to divert investment into renewables.
I called you partly because, Joanna, when I look across the climate action landscape in the West, from Europe through the UK to North America, it seems like I'm hearing a little less about big protests this year, climate action camps and all that. Is that just a lack of media that's too occupied with something else, or is there a lull in climate activism, or is there a different strategy at work now?
Actually, it's a good question. There's no hiatus. There's no lull. Certainly, you know, the march that happened in April in New York again brought out, you know, hundreds of thousands. If anything, it's people will mobilize around a particular event, a particular sense of urgency. The lead up to Paris meant that there was just a lot of people on the streets. But now, you know, now you're seeing much more behind the scenes, local level meetings, meetings that are happening inside city halls, inside shareholder meetings, you know, the recent meeting of Exxon where shareholders actually got up to pass a motion around climate risk. It doesn't look necessarily as visible from a helicopter in terms of numbers of people on the streets, but by no means should any of your listeners think that climate activism is on pause. If anything, it's just getting deeper, more strategic, working with as many different allies, ally governments, you know, different allies of movements, you know, women's movements coming together with Indigenous movements. For so many, climate and environment has come to the top of the agenda. I certainly know just how many requests that our organization gets to come into schools, to come and speak to groups, and, you know, our supporters are increasing, that this is a movement that is strengthening by the day.
I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Joanna Kerr. She's the Executive Director of Greenpeace Canada. Joanna, you arrived at Greenpeace after leading ActionAid. Could you briefly tell us what that is?
So ActionAid is a human rights, humanitarian, and a organization fighting poverty from the bottom up. So it's ActionAid is like the rebellious little sister of Oxfam, and it was created around the same time by the same founder.
Along those lines, do you think that people in very poor countries know that climate change will make things worse, or are they just too busy surviving day to day to get tuned in to the climate problem?
Oh, such a good question. It's actually what brought me to Greenpeace, Alex. I was in northern Ethiopia. It's got to be maybe 5 years ago. I was there to be witnessing this incredible program that ActionAid had partnered with local communities to bring about an end to practices known as female genital mutilation. So, you know, a particularly heinous cultural act against girls. And they had essentially eradicated this practice over the course of 4 or 5 years. And I spent a lot of time with the women in the community, and as I was leaving, just so impressed by these women and what they were up against and what they were able to change. And as I was leaving, I said, is there any message you'd like me to take back? I was going to go back to my office in Johannesburg. Is there any message that you'd like me to take back and share with my colleagues across the world? And this woman leader looked at me and looked at me in the eyes and kind of grabbed my hands and said, could you pray for the rain? And the penny dropped for me. Here we were so focused on this whole human rights situation, but for her, the fact that the rainfall had changed so dramatically over the past few years that she didn't know when to plant the seeds. When the rain would come, it would often come in floods. There'd been, you know, seasons of drought. And for the majority of the world's population living in poverty, they are dependent on the rain for growing their food. So rain and survival are just intimately linked. And so people are extremely aware that weather patterns have changed. They don't necessarily have a word in their local language for climate change, but they are extremely aware. And so poor communities have had to learn how to adapt. And of course, if you look at the droughts that we've been seeing and the floods and the storms and the typhoons in the Philippines, etc., people are very, very aware that this is having a terribly detrimental impact on their lives. They're paying for it the most, and yet they had the least amount to contribute to it. So climate awareness is there. Climate activism is growing by the day.
So what are your priorities for climate action in Canada now?
So our priorities are really twofold right now. We hope to take on, as we've been doing, the expansion of any tar sands that we want to ensure that we move as quickly as possible of the phase out of the tar sands, and that is through very much an Indigenous rights lens, and also that we enable people to see that their water, whether it's oceans or clean water across which pipelines would have to cross, would be protected. So that's absolutely a goal. And similarly, it's the boreal forest. The boreal forest is like this big, beautiful green life ring that sits around the top of the planet that extends across Canada, across Nordic countries, across Russia. The amount of carbon that is captured in these intact forests are essential for the survival of not just all biodiversity that exists on this planet, but as humans. So for us, a huge priority is also protection of these intact forests to also ensure that the rights of Indigenous peoples and their ability to steward their own territories in the protection of these magnificent forests are guaranteed. So it's no small agenda. We hope by 2050 the entire planet is now dependent on renewable energies. We don't have any time to wait. So the more we can really inspire and mobilize people about the possibility, because the solutions exist, not just for getting us into renewables, but also in terms of protecting intact forests, while we can still have strong economies and we can still have a protected environment, you know, that's our goal. And we hope that in the next couple of years, every Canadian would just feel proud to call themselves an environmentalist, because it's us protecting our own lives and our own human rights.
We've been speaking with the Executive Director of Greenpeace Canada, Joanna Kerr. Thank you so much, Joanna.
Thanks, Alex. Lovely to be on your show.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the last year, Belgium has experienced horrible terrorist attacks, as you know, but the Belgian government continues to frighten some of its own residents and their neighbors in the Netherlands and Germany. Why? Because, as in the United States, the government continues to permit old and very risky nuclear reactors to operate way past their original design date. About half the power for all of Belgium comes from two reactor stations called Tihange 2 and Doel 3, and the problems there are so serious, the German government has issued iodine pills to the region bordering Belgium. Even a report from the company running the power station said there could be a major reactor accident any time in the next 10 years. Really, as with Chernobyl, all of Europe is in danger from these atomic plants, and so is everyone in the Northern Hemisphere. On Sunday, June 25th, citizens from three countries will form a human chain stretching from the Tihange reactor in Belgium through Maastricht in Netherlands all the way to Aachen, Germany. To get the story, we go to Jörg Schellenberg from the Aachen Action Alliance Against Atomic Energy. Jörg, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And please pardon my terrible pronunciation of any of the names involved here, but tell us why anti-nuclear groups in Europe are calling for this protest.
So these two reactors, Doel 3 and Tihange 2, are very dangerous because they have thousands of cracks within the reactor pressure vessel. Yes, the heart piece of a nuclear power plant where the nuclear fission takes place. And there are cracks, thousands, ten thousands of cracks in this steel vessel, and they are up to 18 centimeters. And this is a very, very dangerous situation, and no one can say how safe, how much safety margins are remaining in these two reactors.
Well, let's talk about each of these two reactors in turn. What is the Doel 3 reactor, and what is its safety record? Where is it?
Yeah, this reactor is located in Belgium, in the Flemish part, near the city of Antwerp. It's not even 10 kilometers from the city center away. And the other reactor is in Tihange. This is the Maas Valley, where the big city Liège is located around about 20 kilometers away.
Is it true the German government has issued billions of iodine pills out of fear a Belgian reactor will blow?
Yes, they are distributed in northern Westphalia, the western part of Germany, yeah.
And especially for pregnant women, but for everyone, or what?
It's for everyone, up to 45 years.
But doesn't the nuclear fuel for the Belgian reactors actually come from a subsidiary of the French nuclear group Areva, located in the German city of Lingen?
Yes, that's a strange thing. The German government demanding the closure of these two reactors until all safety doubts are away. And despite this, they deliver fuel rods to both nuclear power plants in Belgium. And there would be, by German law, a possibility to stop this export of fuel rods to these plants. And they are doing nothing to stop these horrible things.
So who has the power to do that? Is that the federal government or the local government?
The federal government would be able to stop the exports of these fuel rods to Belgium, yes.
Did the Dutch government ask Belgium for a temporary shutdown of the reactors?
As far as I know, also the government in the Netherlands are demanding the closure of these two reactors. It's more interesting that the municipalities around the border in the Netherlands, in Germany, but also in Luxembourg, they are by now more than 100 municipalities which are demanding the closure of these two reactors and trying to stop them by a lawsuit within Belgium.
And here, to me, is the most fantastic part of all this. According to Wikipedia, the nuclear plant operator Electrabel estimated the chance of a meltdown in the reactors once in every 10 years, and this is due to fire safety. Jörg Schellenberg, can you tell us about that?
I think this was the nuclear regulatory in Belgium, which said there is a huge danger of a meltdown concerning fire issues. And it is very, very strange that nuclear regulatory is saying they are very fearful about it because they have the power to stop it. And if the danger is so high, I raise the question, why don't they shut down these two reactors?
And then we have the problem of safety culture at the two reactors. What is the Belgian government doing to correct that, to make it safer the way it's operated?
Yeah, there are some plans to get more awareness within the staff of these two reactors to rely to normal issues concerning safety, because there is a dramatic failure in the safety culture in these two reactors, and they try to train their staff that this becomes better.
Are we overreacting? Could a meltdown at one of these reactors really bring an accident as serious as Fukushima in Japan or Chernobyl in the Ukraine?
Yeah, it might be. The most dangerous thing is these two reactors are located in very populated areas in Europe. So if you compare it with Fukushima, which was directly located to the Pacific Ocean, in the case of a nuclear accident, for example, in Tihange, a whole Germany would be the Pacific in this situation because the wind blows in the direction of Germany. And so there would not be such a comfortable situation with a west wind drift in the northern hemisphere as it would be in Fukushima, or it was in Fukushima. And so we are running in a more dangerous situation than in Fukushima, of course.
Do you think Germans and really all Europeans are more sensitive to the nuclear problem because of the radiation that landed from Chernobyl when that blew out in 1986?
Yes and no. There are very, very huge differences in the resistance against nuclear power in Europe. So it is very, very strong, especially in Germany. And it is not so strong in Belgium, of course, and also in France. There are very, very much differences in the power which an anti-nuclear movement has in this region.
Jörg, the Belgian reactors have gone down many times due to various emergencies. Did Belgium run out of power then?
No, of course not. Not exactly, not like Japan after Fukushima and the stop of 57 nuclear power plants there. This is only a strategy to fear people. We have a European-wide grid which can help to keep in power in Belgium. And so this is not true. So by normal, Belgium has a phase out, and by now already 2 gigawatts of electric power should have shut down, and they have not shut down it. So it would be possible to shut down these two reactors.
Well, we know they're going to have to close or have a terrible accident sooner or later, and maybe sooner. Is Belgium working hard to install safe alternative energy like solar and wind, as Germany has been doing?
So the phase-out law is from 2003, and since then there were not much installation of renewable energy in the country. By now it starts to grow a little bit, but if you would like to have a transition to renewable energy, they have to work very, very hard on this.
This is Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Our guest is the German anti-nuclear activist Jörg Schellenberg. What happened, Jörg, with the German nuclear reactors after the Fukushima nuclear accident?
Yeah, there were huge protests in Germany all around, I think on more than 500 places all over Germany, with more than 200,000 people demanding the closure of the nuclear power stations in Germany after Fukushima. And finally, we succeed and came back to an already decided phase out of nuclear power before. It was strange because the government decided in the autumn before Fukushima that the phase-out of nuclear energy should be rolled back and gave a huge more time for all reactors. And after Fukushima, this phase-out of the phase-out was rolled back so that we came to a phase-out which will end in the beginning of the 2020s.
Well, let's be honest, Jörg, are the German reactors really safer than the Belgian ones?
It's a complicated question. I think, yes, they are safer than the two reactors, Doel 3 and Tihange 2, but they are not safer in general, because I think before the disasters in Fukushima, the whole world was sure that Japan has the most reliable power plants in the whole world. And afterwards, it was changed. So if a country is running in a nuclear accident, they mostly lost all their reputations, and they are blamed about it so that all other countries can run nuclear power further on.
I began by mentioning terror attacks in Belgium. What are the possible terrorist threats to these Belgian nuclear power stations, and what has happened already?
Yes, there might be. There was an attack from the employees within one of the nuclear power plants in Belgium, Doel 4, which was sabotaged by their own employees. And by now it's not clear who did it, because afterwards there were found some jihadists within the power plant which were employed there.
And was there not also a Belgian nuclear executive who was murdered and his cards for entry to the stations stolen?
Yeah, there was stolen some identity cards, and he was observed by terrorists, and this was also a threatened situation for Belgium, because he had access to very sensitive areas within a nuclear power plant, yes.
Where does the nuclear waste from Tihang 2 and Doel 3, where does that nuclear waste go?
By now it's located in the nuclear power plant or beside the nuclear power plant on this area. And like in all other countries, there is no situation where it's definitely where you can put this nuclear waste forever.
And the reactors are owned by a company called Electrabel. Who owns and controls that company?
This is a company which is owned by a French company which is called ENGIE, and they are a very, very huge provider of electric and other energy, and their only nuclear power plants are located in Belgium.
So the profits go to a French company?
The profit goes to a French company, right, yes.
Who are the local groups organizing against this, and has Greenpeace been involved in protests?
Yes, there are much grassroots movements like the one I'm engaged in, but we're working also with Greenpeace and other groups together to fight on different levels against this, especially these two reactors, on a scientific level, on a level of juristical things, and also like normal demonstrations on the street.
So what do you want to see happen after the big human chain protest on June 25th?
I think it's a huge sign if hopefully tens of thousands of people are joining, giving each other a hand through three European countries saying we don't want to be threatened anymore by these nuclear power plants. And this is a huge sign, and I think one step more on our way that these two reactors will close soon. And of course it won't close because we are organizing a human chain. But this is one piece in our attack and our fight against these two reactors.
We've been talking with anti-nuclear activist Jörg Schellenberg. He's with the group Aachen Action Alliance Against Atomic Energy. Jörg, would you take a minute and tell our German-speaking listeners in your own language the real name of your group and where they can find you for this action?
Yeah, der Name lautet Aachener Aktionsbündnis gegen Atomenergie. Und ihr könnt uns finden unter www.stop-tihange.org. Dort gibt es dann alle Informationen zur Menschenkette.
Jörg, thank you so much for being our guest on Radio EcoShock.
I thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
And here's a little nuclear gossip for you. Ex-General and ex-National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had to disclose his business venture flogging lots and lots of nuclear reactors in the volatile Middle East. In Newsweek, June 9th, journalist Jeff Stein reported Flynn was flown to Egypt and Israel to feel out, quote, a fantastical plan for a joint U.S.-Russian, and Saudi-financed, program to get control over the Arab world's rush to acquire nuclear power, end quote. As the American nuclear industry is dying, somebody wanted Flynn to go where the money is. More nukes. For our own safety, of course. Tick, tick, tick. That's it for Radio EcoShock. Please join me again next week.